Hello, hello, and welcome to the 15th episode of Pints of Football. We are your hosts, Himanshu and Ayusha. How's it going, Ayusha?
I mean, it was a great week of football for me. All the transfer news, a great Champions League final. I think it was tactically a supreme game. But I'm pretty sure it was a rough week for you given the outcome. And now that United are not the only English team to have completed a treble in England.
I'm only thankful for you to keep it at very drunken night so that I forget a lot of things which happened that night. But yes, terrible week for me. A very good week for the neutrals, I believe. Because it was a lackluster match to watch. But then that led to the opening of the transfer season. That led to a lot of tweets of Grealish that we could see. A lot of photos from the events of the celebration, which was honestly very funny to see. So, good week of football. A good end to the season, I would say. But moving on, beyond what we have to discuss in terms of the City treble, we'll also compare them to the United team of 1999 and see who were the better off. So you obviously know my opinion. We'll see what Ayusha as a neutral has to say. We also cover the transfer market. We separate the rumors from facts and we tell you what we think would be ideal fit for these teams instead. So without further ado, let's start this episode.
A lot has been said and already written about this game, so we'll keep the things extremely short. Couple of talking points straight away. Both teams lined up pretty much the way we had expected them to. The only change coming from Inter Milan's side was dropping Mkhitaryan for Brazovic, which in my personal opinion turned out to be a very good move because Inter executed their plan to the T. Going forward, we did not see a lot from Inter up until late in the second half. But otherwise, there were three defenders. There was a huge shield of five midfielders, you can say, with the wing backs coming up and then pushing back. And in a sense, what they did was they completely reduced the gap for City to run in. We saw very little from Kevin De Bruyne. We saw very little from Ilkay Gundogan. And even when John Stones was stepping into midfield, there was not a lot he could do. One of the things which we also saw in this game was were very willing to let Jack Grealish off the ball. They were more focused on not allowing the ball They were more focused on not allowing City to pass the ball through the midfield. It's almost like they picked their poison. They ensured that City were attacking through two or three predictable channels. Through all of this, they were able to really keep the City team very tightly under control. Last thing was obviously how beautifully they neutralized Erling Haaland. The trade-off of all of this was that they could do very little going forward.
Exactly. Italian teams, as they are genetically, you know, designed, were very good defensively, but they had very little to offer going forward. There was just a little bit of time, maybe in the second half. Obviously, Man City were a bit nervous. Have had a very long season winning so many trophies that they then started, you know, going back. Then they had Lukaku on.
I think drinking all that alcohol in Manchester had an impact.
So that's what happened. Man City didn't execute the plan to perfection, I would say. Inter Milan, in fact, got a lot of things right defensively. But then if you analyze the entire season, maybe Man City did deserve to win. On that night, Inter were pretty good, but not good enough.
I mean, and all the jokes, Romelu Lukaku aside, he would be really disappointed, right, with his performance in that game, considering the chances he got, especially the header he got, which he shot down straight into the thighs of Edison. That's a massive, massive miss for a striker of his pedigree. And all of this is coming back, you know, on the back of what happened in the World Cup, where he also missed major, major chances, three or four, which led to Belgium being knocked out in the round of 16. So it's going to be very interesting to see whether he can recover from these setbacks and whether Inter now should be as gung-ho about keeping him at the club as they were, you know, at the start of the season when they got him on loan. So
no, it's just a cheaper resource, right? I mean, he will have those disappointing performances in final and maybe a big match. But then he will get Inter Milan through a lot of league matches and somehow get them Champions League football again. So for that, I think he's pretty much cheap. Also, because Chelsea are so willing to sell right now. But moving on from this, Ayusha, a good match to watch. Man City have had a brilliant season. How would you compare this City team to the United team of 1999?
I think I want to, you know, create a combined 11 of the two. But right off the bat of it, one thing which... And remember, we are comparing only the treble season. We are not looking at the careers because obviously that United team, the class of 92, so many of these players were at the club for 10, 15 years. And they've had stellar careers. So we have to wait for the career of some of these City players to wind up before we pass a holistic judgment. But on that particular season alone, one thing which clearly stands out is I think this City team are more dominant than what that Manchester United team was. And secondly, and a lot of that I think has to do with the style of football that Pep Guardiola plays. And obviously, the way the game has evolved in terms of City having so much in terms of resources. Secondly, I definitely think City have a better squad than what United had. They also have a bigger squad than what United had. These are the two areas where I think City clearly stand out ahead of United. So before this podcast, I was going through the starting lineup for the final versus Bayern Munich. And I know it's just one game in that big season. But I don't know if you remember, but there was a defender called Blomqvist, if I'm pronouncing him correctly, who had to stand for United in the final. Obviously, Keane and Scholes were out, were suspended from the finals. But still, that just shows you how much United had to, you know, fix a lot of things along the way in that season. And also in terms of defense, right? If you look at the squad, Dennis Irwin, Gary Neville and Yap Stam. But Ferguson did not have a fixed fourth defender in that team. He rotated between Phil Neville, Wes Brown got a couple of games in, and then there was Ronnie Johnson. So winning a treble without having a fixed back four lineup, let's say, unlike what Pep had in the second half of the season, was truly spectacular. So I think these are where I think holistically you can look at these squads. So Himanshu, let's just dive into what we think is the best combined 11 from the two treble winning teams. And at least you can still take some pride that the treble accolade is still restricted to Manchester only and not outside of it. I'm sure it'll be in London someday. But yeah, I won't digress. So in goal, we both agree, right? The formation has to be 4-3-3.
It's the modern formation. So yeah, 4-3-3. But I think 4-3-3 was unheard of during back in the day. But let's stick to 4-3-3 for the sake of this argument.
Yeah. So in goal, I think both you and I can agree that we'll both go with Kasper Schmeichel.
Yes, I was hoping you would say his name, but Ederson probably had that one save in the entire Champions League, you know, roundup where we remember him. But Kasper Schmeichel was so instrumental to that team. It's just his presence as, you know, one of the leaders at the back. So yeah, for me, it'll be Schmeichel over Ederson.
Now we move to the defense, where I think this is one area where we might see a Manchester United dominance, but let's go ahead. On the right side, between Gary Neville and Kyle Walker, who is your choice and why?
I'd have to go with Gary Neville because he was a mainstay at right back for the entire season, while Kyle Walker was used in situations where, you know, let's say he has to come up against Vinicius Jr. He was used there. But then again, against Inter, where there's less wing threat, he wasn't used. And Gary Neville was there for all matches. So for me, it's Gary Neville over Kyle Walker.
I totally agree with you. I think Neville was a mainstay of the United team and not a strategic ploy like Kyle Walker was. So straight away with Neville. I think in the center of the park, one of the defenders, both you and I agree, has to be Yap Stam. It doesn't matter whether you compare him to Rodri or Stone. Stam just walks into any combined all-time All-Star 11. Who's going to be the other central defender, according to you? Is it going to be Stone or is it going to be
Diaz?
Diaz
because didn't have a stellar season as expected from him. But John Stone's really shown, I mean, in terms of his versatility, you know, moving up front, etc. So for me, John Stone's, at least this season.
Definitely, I agree with you. And on the left side, it's going to be a bit interesting. We have the all-time legend, Dennis Irwin, and he's going up against Ake, and sometimes Akanji was deployed over there. I think Irwin straight away comes into this team, right? He can play on both wings. He can play down the center. He's our left back without any doubt.
Correct. I think when you look at Man City's left back, none of us know who's going to really be picked for that match. But for Manchester United, it was always Dennis Irwin. For that reason, we both agree.
From the defense, we move to the midfield three. I'll take the easier choice. Roy Keane straight away is that shield, that pivot in front of the defense. I think even Pep Guardiola would pick a Roy Keane any day of the year. Maybe he will not last under Pep Guardiola for long because of his ego. But Keane, surely, right? 53 games, 5 goals, captain, leader, legend.
Exactly. I mean, if it wasn't that, like, it's a little bit of an argument because Rodri did score the winning goal in the final while Keane missed the final. But then Keane had that stellar performance against Juventus in the semi-final, which you cannot forget. And Roy Keane had an overall better season as well. So yes, both of us should agree it's Roy Keane.
Now is the more interesting part, right? Who are going to be your other two midfielders? Because I'll tell you what the options are. We have Nicky Butt, we have Paul Scholes, we have Kevin De Bruyne. And then we have Ilkay Gundogan.
So when it comes to the number 8 position, and of course, Gundogan does wear the number 8 itself. If you look at Gundogan, maybe it's a recency effect. I really love him. I really love the way he kind of, you know, the way he gets forward, right? He almost plays like a second striker. At the same time, he's very much prevalent in midfield in the build-up play. So for that reason, I was going with Gundogan. And then, interestingly, when we looked up the facts and you brought it to my attention, Gundogan and Scholes have the same number of goals. So I'm a little bit like you know, inclined towards my interest to Manchester United and hence biased towards Scholes. But what would you say, Avish?
I mean, I totally see the case for Ilkay Gundogan. He played more number of games. If there was one person to the City team, apart from De Bruyne, who was a mainstay, it was Ilkay Gundogan. But I just think you can't look past the class of Paul Scholes. At the end of the day, that just outshines everything. And that's why even I agree with you, Scholes has to be there. On the other side of the midfield, hands down, right? Kevin De Bruyne has to be there over anybody else.
To be honest, I don't even remember who used to play in attacking midfield position. But of course, we had a 4-4-2 at United back then. I don't think there's any argument for any other player than De Bruyne at this stage.
So moving on to our front three, let's deal with the most difficult choice. Who's going to be our number nine? Our options are Erling Haaland, Andy Cole, Dwight York, and on the bench, the babyface assassin, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Oh, don't forget, he's won 4 trophies. He's gone beyond the treble.
Yeah, he's won more than any other Man City player right now. But of course, Andy Cole, Dwight York had brilliant seasons. I think together they were an amazing partnership. Both of them got 20-odd goals for the season, so brilliant. But then, if you really look at that one man who probably gobbled both of them up, it's Erling Haaland. What an incredible season he has had. He is our player of the year, Pints of Football player of the year, if that's a thing. So for me, it has to be Erling Haaland. I mean, I love Andy Cole. I love Dwight York. But these two players put into one and put a few more inches on top of them and you get Erling Haaland. So I'm going with Haaland.
Perfect. No arguments over there. On the left side of the pitch, the choice is between Ryan Giggs and Jack Grealish. I don't rate Ryan Giggs highly as a player, but I'm going with Ryan Giggs for this. 36 games, 10 goals. I think he's just, on any given day, more consistent than what a Jack Grealish can ever be.
Yeah, it's also both of them are slightly maybe one-dimensional players. But then again, Ryan Giggs was a left-sided winger who played with his left foot. Grealish has a slightly more, you know, goal scoring because he's an inverted winger, right? So he cuts in and scores more goals. But then comparing the two, Grealish has maybe another season to reach his peak. While Ryan Giggs was also, you know, had a brilliant season that time. I think he also scored that goal against Arsenal in the FA Cup where, you know, he beefed through the entire midfield and defense of Arsenal. And we all saw his hairy chest. Very brilliant.
And treated us to that image, which I still can't get out of my mind.
And then 10 years from here, we'll remember Grealish's image of, you know, celebrating on top of the bus. But yes, I think maybe Giggs edges this one.
Definitely. No arguments with you over there. On the right side of the pitch now, the choice is between Lionel Messi's new boss, let's say David Beckham. And then it's Bernardo Silva and Riyad Mahrez. I think we have a disagreement over here, right? Mahrez, even though a good player, probably more skilled than both of these guys, is still not at that level. I'm going with David Beckham for this. Especially given Haaland in the center. I think Haaland would have a field day with Beckham's pinpoint crosses. He will play the ball quicker into him. But on his own, I think Beckham had a standout season. 53 games, 9 goals. In the final, when Keane and Scholes both were missing, he played in the center of the park. Made a difference with his corners. I think there were times when Bernardo was not playing this season over and Riyad Mahrez was being preferred over him. So that is another reason why I think Beckham was just more crucial to Manchester United than what Bernardo was to City across the entire season, not just the second half of the season.
Right. For me, I mean, of course, I am a Beckham fanboy through and through. But then it's just for the team, Bernardo Silva was so important in terms of, you know, his tracking back, etc. But I think I'll let you have this one if it's Beckham or Bernardo Silva. Yeah, Beckham, we can go for it.
Perfect. So that's our combined travel team in a formation 4-4-3-3. Our goalkeeper, Schmeichel. Our defenders, Gary Neville, Yap Stam, John Stones, Dennis Irwin. Our midfield, Roy Keane, Kevin De Bruyne, Paul Scholes. And then up front, we have David Beckham. On the other flank, we have Ryan Giggs. And through the center of the park, we have the Norwegian brute, Erling Haaland.
You realize we've picked 8 Man United players.
That's why I never got around to the manager discussion, which would be Pep Guardiola over Sir Alex. But that would take an entire episode to convince you. From looking back on the final that went by, we come to the section that is all about looking forward. And that is the transfer market. Leveraging on our, you know, business education background, we've come up with a framework as to how a team should approach the transfer market. You can either jump into the market in a completely haphazard manner and build a squad of 40 people and buy whoever is available for absurd amount of money like Chelsea did last year. Or you jump into the market and try to build based on what is the stage of development that your club is in. And the club can be in 2 stages of development. Either you can be in a year of transition or a period of transition where for financial reasons or for the age of your squad or if you're looking to change the style of play, you are trying to build a new team. You are trying to transition to something new, transition to something different. or you can be a team which is trying to get to the next level, which means we have achieved a level of stability. You are showing promise. You're competing for trophies now. But the next step is to make that happen. And that means you'll be looking for those one or two signings, those one or two clinical signings. Think like a Robin Van Persie for Manchester United, or a Didier Drogba for Chelsea, or you can say about Cristiano Ronaldo for Real Madrid, that kind of a signing, which will take you straight away to the next level. So you can be either in a tier of transition, or you can be a team which is trying to go to the next level. And in this section, we'll discuss some of the big teams in Europe. In which phase do we think they are? With that, Himanshu, let's start by focusing two big teams which are actually in a year of transition, right? One of them is Paris Saint-Germain, who even though they won the league, are suddenly in a big soup. And then the second team is Real Madrid, who even though they were in the Champions League semi-final, actually ended up finishing third in the La Liga. So let's kickstart the discussion about PSG. Messi, as we all know, has left the club. This is again an aging squad. Sergio Ramos is on the older side. Verratti is no longer as reliable as he used to be. And on top of that, PSG have had to let go of their manager. They've had a disappointing year in the Champions League. They have a lot of players who are...
It was a very fun, how do you say, view for a neutral with what Mbappe does. It's like suddenly there's no attention to Mbappe and he goes and writes this open letter to the president stating that he's not renewing. I mean, the letter was honestly nothing. If you look at it on, you know, on paper, technically, yeah, he's just saying, I won't renew next season. So just to confirm that it's a 3-season contract and 3 seasons ends next season, I won't be renewing and you're free to do whatever you want to do about it. And obviously this freaked out PSG who are built on reputation. They don't want to be taken on a ride by a club like, you know, clubs like Real Madrid, United, etc. What happened last time, I'm sure if you remember, he had 1 season left and Real Madrid bid, I think, 180, 200 million pounds, which is a crazy amount to bid for a person who has 1 year left on his contract. PSG still refused. And I think it's pretty much the same thing, man. PSG will not be taken for a ride. They don't mind losing him on a free, but money has never been an issue for them. Maybe it'll help them to settle accounts for financial fair play, but they don't give a fuck about that either. So that's where we are at right now. I think Mbappe will stay on for another season. He wants to as well. He's come on and said he wants to. PSG will also figure it out. And that's what we'll see of Mbappe. But very interesting, as you said, Ramos is now a free agent. Messi is gone. Neymar is questionable in terms of situation. And then PSG has been buying these youngsters. They bought Asensio, not a youngster anymore. They bought Ugarte, who Chelsea were very keen on. It's a very good buy since Verratti is aging right now. And I think they're very close to signing a couple of other players. And then Galtier has left, as you had predicted. So it's a season of transition for PSG, as you rightly said. Interesting to see who they will scoop up in the next couple of weeks.
And I think I slightly disagree on the Mbappe part, because I think this is a dignified way of him trying to push the situation. You know, wherein if he's sold right now, he can take the moral high ground. And he's okay with it. And if he's not sold, then next year, you know, the whole Mbappe clan, they can even demand more fees personally for Kylian and sign on amounts and greater perks. But for PSG, obviously, it's a big, big problem. Financial fair play is becoming a reality even for them. Secondly, if they do sell Mbappe right now, the big question is, what do they do with that 160, 170, 150, whatever money they get? Suddenly, there are a lot of decisions that they have to make as a club. And also, in the market, they're not linked to a lot of players right now, if you look at it. So, yeah, truly interesting.
They might be heading the Chelsea way. Yeah, but just buying a lot of youngsters and hoping that it works out for them a couple of seasons on.
You know,
but yeah, let's move on to...
Quite frankly, they are one of the clubs which should be doing it. Because if you just look at the pool of talent, young players that France produces and then clubs all over the world buy, specifically the Paris region... I mean, it's mind-boggling, and the fact that they have not tapped into that that Parisian youth and the French youth, in spite of building such a big training ground, having a great scout setup, is just surprising. But yeah, moving to the club, which will have a huge interest in this Mbappe situation, and which has already made a couple of big moves in the transfer market, that's Real Madrid. For Madrid, their defense looks still sorted, right? Militao is 25, Alaba is 30, Rudiger is 30, Carvalho is 31, Ferland Mendy is 28, Vasquez, even though he's 31, has so much energy in his body. But it's the midfield where all the focus is right now, and now also on the front line. On the front line, Benzema's departure has left a huge vacuum, as we discovered live while recording our 13th episode. And on top of that, now that midfield, Modric is 37, Cruz is 33. Ceballos is not your starter for a team like Madrid, which means they now have Camavinga 20. They have Tchouaméni 23. They have Valverde, who's 24. And now they have Jude Bellingham, their marquee signing for close to 130 million, who's also 20 years old or 21. So for Madrid as a team, more, and we'll get to the front line, but even as a team, they're moving from something so reliable and so dependable to an entirely new setup and a new spine, right? It's clearly a big year of transition for them.
Exactly. I mean, not just midfield. Now, of course, they have wrapped up probably the biggest signing of the summer, right? In Jude Bellingham. I don't think anybody else will probably go for someone as big as him, unless someone, you know, dares to go for Osimhen, maybe. So you never know what's coming for Real Madrid this time, especially now that Benzema has gone to Al Hilal. I think maybe the next person that they're looking for is a proper number nine, and maybe not just a proper number nine, even someone who can play in that role in a Kylian Mbappe. And that's why I feel like that letter that Kylian Mbappe wrote is a little bit of a masala on top of all this as to what might happen.
Before I talk to you more, pick your brain more about Kylian. What kind of role do you think Bellingham play for Madrid? Because traditionally, when they have gone, you know, for these big marquee signings, like 100 million plus signings, breaking record signings, they usually go for players whose output you can tangibly see, right? Mostly in terms of goals is what I'm talking about. Bellingham has not necessarily been, you know, that Frank Lampard type of player at Dortmund, at least, who would go and bang in 20 goals a season, or, you know, playing off the striker. So when he comes into this Madrid team, do you think it's also a role change for him now, considering you already have Tchouaméni, you have Camavinga, you also have Cruz and Modric also, you know, if they start games to sit back? Do you think he now takes that role where he becomes a proper, let's say, number 10?
Exactly, Ayush. I think he will be involved more in front. Although he is a box-to-box midfielder, he can make those runs. I just don't see him being a number 10. Maybe not that up front. He'll be expected to do a lot of defensive duties as well. Maybe something like a Modric. But then, of course, Modric was not involved in as many goals as you expected him to. He's more of a, you know, someone who brings in assists, someone who gets the game going. That's probably what's expected of Bellingham as well. He'll learn under the best midfielders that he has as tutors, and Cruz and Modric. And he'll become something amazing. I don't really see what role. I don't really understand what role he'll probably be filling in at Real Madrid. But an exciting couple of seasons ahead for Jude Bellingham. And, you know, I just don't want to apply that Bundesliga tax on him, as we did for Sancho, as we did for maybe even Kai Havertz. I think Jude Bellingham has a strong head on his shoulders. He'll probably really learn from the best and probably be a Ballon d'Or winner in the next few years.
I think he'll really have to win over that Madrid fan base, which we know are extremely difficult to win over. Because one thing for sure I can tell you is not a lot of people in Madrid would be watching Dortmund games to be... A lot of fans would genuinely be wondering why have we spent 100 plus million on a player from Dortmund, and that too, who's an English guy. So he really will have to win these fans over. I do think he's going to get a more advanced role in this Madrid team. Mm-hmm. Also because of the age of Modric and Cruz, I think he'll just have to step up more, because Modric and Cruz will still start games. It's not like Ancelotti will put an entirely new midfield three from game one. But moving to the Madrid forward line, Vinicius, Rodrigo, you know, they're there. They've signed a backup striker also, but now they really do have that Benzema-sized gap which they have to fill, right? And something tells me that they might just wait 1 year to sign Mbappe, but they still have to fill that number 9 gap. And do you think they will go ahead and sign a proper number 9? And if yes, the first question off my bat straight away is, are they going to go for somebody like an Osimhen, who's burst onto the scene last year? Or they try to make it, or they try to do something which will really excite me, is seeing Harry Kane at Real Madrid. And they have been linked. Or the third option, which is surprising, Kai Havertz, which is a real link, right? I mean, Havertz is, as of now, the front runner to end up at Madrid if they can meet Chelsea's valuation.
I think Havertz, I mean, I get your point, and Havertz might be just the person to fill in Benzema's, you know, the hole that Benzema's left there. But they have to kind of save up money for Mbappe either ways, either buying him right now, which will be expensive, even buying him as a free agent. I'm sure Mbappe will milk them for everything they have as a signing on fee and this and that, I don't know what else, right? They still have to kind of save up money for Mbappe. So I don't see them signing a proper number 9 or an expensive number 9 at least. They've already signed Joselu, as you mentioned. They'll probably buy another, you know, understudy or a backup number 9 just to fill that gap for one season. and Rodrigo and Vinicius Jr. will have to do a lot of heavy lifting up front.
Well, again, you know, I might slightly disagree. Is they cannot not have Mbappe and not have a proper number 9 this season. I think one of those two things, according to me, has to work, because I don't think Madrid can go without challenging, at least at the start of the season. I don't think they can put out a team which will not challenge for the Champions League and not challenge for the La Liga, especially considering Barca won it last season. I think they will really go hard for Harry Kane. It's a different thing that Harry Kane might not want to leave England because of Schürrle's record. The Havertz decision really baffles me, because I just don't know. I mean, he's not filling that Benzema size gap. I am a big Havertz fan, but you know, at Chelsea, he couldn't be that guy. Yeah. I mean, he'd do the link up play and the ball distribution, but being that clinical guy in front of goal is going to be extremely tricky. Ideally for Madrid, I think they should sign somebody like Harry Kane. I think Mbappe will have a field time with Harry Kane when he comes to Madrid next year. Easily he's going to create God knows how many goals for Kylian.
Yeah, that'll be... it's a FIFA kind of a, you know, team that we set up with Harry Kane and Mbappe. I'd love for that to happen, but just don't see it happening. I don't think there's that much money in the world for Real Madrid to invest in both a Harry Kane, which will be like £180 million this season, and then sign Mbappe on free. Even if it's free with all the salary and, you know, other things that they'll have to pay up, it might be too expensive. But you're right. But it's Real Madrid.
One thing which can make it happen and also have the finances and might still make a profit after doing all of this, it's Real Madrid. Amidst all of this, it's so important that they still have Ancelotti as their manager, right? To ride them out to this period of transition. Imagine having a new manager on top of all of this.
Right. It seems like Ancelotti will definitely stay one more season. Post that, when Mbappe comes in next season, as we are kind of predicting right now, it'll be a crazy year of transition. I mean, whoever comes will have to handle whoever they have as a number 9, as you suggested, and a new Mbappe. So crazy job on hand for whoever is the next manager of Real Madrid. Next, Ayusha, let's move on to the teams who are now expected to move on to that next level. Firstly, Manchester United. It just feels for me that we had a very good season. We have Champions League qualification, which seemed very far in the first half of the season, and we have somehow achieved it. We also got a trophy to add to it. Now it felt like the board has to now support Erik ten Hag to get his kind of players into the team, as we both agreed that it was more of a, somehow he has scraped together some team to get in through the season, but this is not the way ten Hag wants to play in a long-term basis. And now what we're seeing is it's very sluggish in terms of their approach to the transfer market, as United have always been. Very similar to last season. They're going very slowly, while people are picking up very good players. Rivals are picking up very good players. Kim Min-jae, who we were linked to, and I was kind of confident that they'd complete that signing, doesn't look like it'll happen now, because Bayern have come in. And once Bayern come in, it's pretty much a done deal for them. Then we look at striker, and very publicly, I think even Fabrizio Romano has covered that they're out of the Harry Kane race, because it feels like very impractical to deal with Daniel Levy, who doesn't want to sell to a rival. Then there is, of course, Rasmus Højlund. Rasmus Højlund seemed like a cheaper striker who they could bring in. Again, it doesn't seem like Atlanta want to, you know, are willing to kind of give that cheaper price for Rasmus Højlund. He has kind of fit into the mold of Haaland, so maybe they're expecting Haaland kind of a money for Rasmus Højlund. That's become a bit of an issue. And then Mason Mount, the biggest name in terms of Manchester United transfers going around right now, they've had a bid of £40 million rejected by Chelsea, even though he has one season left on his contract. In my opinion, it's a very fair bid. Not accepted. It doesn't look like they'll accept anything close to, you know, even 50 if United were able to increase that. So what do you think, Ayusha? What do you think of the transfer season United is going through, and how do you think we'll end up?
I think it's what you pointed out right at the beginning of this analysis of United is very, very true, which is United have traditionally been they have traditionally been extremely slow to move in the transfer market. They have not at all been, you know, precise, quick and rapid in the signings they make. A lot of them turn out to be these long, protracted public displays, which is very different from how Manchester City operate, or, you know, how Liverpool operate. For example, everybody was shocked when Liverpool ended up signing McAllister for $35 million. When earlier, the price roaming around in the market, you know, was McAllister will go for $70 million, $80 million. Look at how Madrid, how quickly they have wrapped up. The season ended and within 1 week, they have wrapped up the whole Bellingham signing. And I think that's how clubs should operate. And again, United over here are stuck in this situation, same like last season, right? Where it was, will we sign Frankie de Jong? Will we not sign Frankie de Jong? And that was pretty much just dominated the entire season. And then in the end, because of fan pressure, the Glazers had to make panic buys and getting Casemiro, and Anthony had to come in for a vastly bloated 80, 85 million. And you, as a United fan, you just have to be worried, what if something like this happens this year? And all of it is further complicated by the whole question of the takeover, right? And a huge reason why United maybe are not able to, let's say, properly stretch their wings is also because of the takeover. Maybe the committee does not know, the sporting director, the technical directors, they do not know how much money they can actually go out there and actually spend in the transfer market. And also, it's not like it's a very seasoned team of the sporting director and the technical director at Manchester United. I mean, for God's sake, Darren Fletcher is in one of those roles. I think that says all you need to know. So, a very precarious time for Manchester United. They definitely do need a midfielder. They definitely, I think defense is the one position they can manage. They definitely need a midfielder. And if not Mount, even the other options that everybody's talking about, like Caicedo, they're already linked to other clubs in advanced stages of negotiation. So, United really have to act quickly on the whole Harry Kane part. I know Rasmus Højlund is being discussed, but his numbers are not great. I think he barely scored 8 or 11 goals for Atlanta in this area. So based on everything that's gone on, while United seem poised at this moment to go to the next level, if they continue to operate like this in the transfer market, they are not going to that next level, not this season at least.
For sure, man. I agree with most of these points. Very worrying signs for United fans right now. Moving on, Ayusha, to another team who should be stepping on to the next level, Arsenal, who had a brilliant season. Very similar in terms of, you know, expectation, and what they achieved was really a lot. They qualified for the Champions League. They didn't win the Premier League, unfortunately, but we can all agree that it's been a brilliant season for them in terms of progression. Who have they set their eyes on, Ayusha? And I hear it's players very close to your heart.
For Arsenal, the reason I say, you know, they are a team ready to move to the next level, because the numbers that are involved in some of the signings they are trying to make are completely antithetical to what have been the Arsenal transfer over the past couple of seasons. Their going in bid for Declan Rice was £80 million. And now they're going back with £100 million for Declan Rice. The fact that they're willing to spend so much amount of money, and the fact that Declan Rice looks at himself like being an Arsenal player, is automatically a sign of the fact that the club's reputation has changed and the club wants to do serious things. They're also going toe-to-toe with Madrid in the race for Kai Havertz. They're going to a bid close to around £60 million for Kai Havertz. And they're ready to go up to £70 million, which apparently is what is Chelsea's asking price. And Chelsea obviously are reluctant to sell Havertz to a rival. But again, these are the two players they're trying to sign. Honestly, Arsenal are only short in 2-3 positions, right? They do need a number 9. And that is where I want to pick your brain about, again, the whole Havertz signing and whether it makes sense for them or not. But with Granit Xhaka leaving, I think Declan Rice is a signing which makes sense for them. So let's first of all, you know, talk about Declan Rice. At West Ham, we have seen him play in a very withdrawn role, right? Up until last season, he was almost playing like that second man in front of defense. This season, even at West Ham, we have seen him get slightly more freedom. I'm not going to ask whether he's the right signing for Arsenal or the money we talked about last time. But where does he play in Arsenal? Do you think him being a him taking over the role full-time from Thomas Partey, given Partey's fitness struggles? Or do you see him going forward and playing in a position where Granit Xhaka was this season alongside Odegaard?
I've seen a lot of Declan Rice interviews where, you know, he's up and close with, I think, Gary Neville a couple of times in the overlap as well, where he's mentioned that he would love to play in an advanced role. Very similar to what happened to Granit Xhaka as well. He was playing in a number 6 role. Then he transitioned into a number 8 role in a more advanced position this season, and he's excelled at it. So for me, if Granit Xhaka can do so well, I'm sure Declan Rice could do a much better job in a more advanced number 8 position. The way Arteta sees things, in my opinion, it'll probably be Partey who'll be sitting in that pivot position for a bit, at least 2-3 more years down the line. So him and maybe Jorginho as well. And while Declan Rice gets to play slightly more advanced. And I feel like Declan Rice has the tools to play the advanced role because he is very good in terms of ball progression.
Xhaka, at the end of the day, has left the club. That's the more glaring gap for Arteta to fill in. But even in Partey's position, right, I think Arsenal should try to get somebody, right, who can play alongside Partey, because apparently Jorginho is on his way out of the club.
Right, if Jorginho goes, I think they'll have to buy some kind of an understudy to Partey, because as we have seen, right, he's had parts of season where he doesn't really play that well or gets injured. They'll definitely need a backup for Partey, but on a long-term sense of thing, maybe if you look at the money, they probably keep some money to buy someone as a complete replacement for Xhaka an understudy for Partey would probably sort out their finances.
So the other player now Arsenal are being heavily linked with is Kai Havertz, and the fact that they're ready to spend that kind of money for him means they're in some serious business.
Right.
My first question is, given the Arsenal squad, is Kai Havertz the kind of or the profile of player they should prioritize?
That is an interesting question, and honestly, I can't figure it out. I've seen a lot of pundits argue as well. Like, what does Kai Havertz really bring in? Is he a number nine, a proper number nine? I don't think so, because neither is he so pacey, and neither is he like strong enough to be a number nine. So is he like more of a someone who can just play off a proper striker, like if he's playing off Gabriel Jesus? But that brings into question, then what does Odegaard do? He's the captain of the team, right? He's never going to, you know, be on the bench. So spending 70 plus on a player who's not going to be playing most matches, it's a bit questionable, unless Arteta has something in his mind, you know, in terms of his position.
Maybe he's reimagining the entire team, and Rice actually plays in the position of Thomas Partey. And then you have Odegaard and Havertz playing behind Jesus, with the option that if ever Jesus gets injured, in case of Nketiah, you know, Havertz can start occupying that hole. Maybe he's thinking something like that. But yeah, even I... They're basically hypotheticals. You don't see a clear-cut style of play for Kai Havertz in that team. I mean, it's similar like Madrid, right? Even for Madrid, I don't know exactly what and where Havertz goes in. I think it's the same place at Arsenal. In the Arsenal defense, though, we haven't heard a lot of rumblings about who's going to be the kind of defender they're going to sign. But they do need a defender, right? Or are they going to bank on Saliba being fit for the rest of the season? Are they going to bank on that?
I think just because of his age, maybe Saliba will be banked on to at least play the entire of next season. The Polish guy, whose name I don't recall much, was impressive in the few matches that he played. So maybe they're banking on these three defenders, as well as Gabriel, who's been there for a couple of seasons now. So maybe they are thinking in terms of priority, let's just look at the front and the midfield to kind of have reinforcements. And maybe at the end of the transfer season, they look for the one opportunity to bring in maybe a centre-back. Or even maybe play a Kieran Tierney, who is now pretty much second fiddle to Zinchenko, to then, you know, fit into a centre-back position whenever required.
I think a lot of what Arsenal are chasing, as we mentioned, if Madrid are serious about signing Havertz, they will lose Havertz. And even the Declan Rice signing, though, there are rumblings now that Manchester City might go for Declan Rice. A lot of what City do will depend on Bernardo Silva and Ilkay Gundogan's contract situations. Gundogan is free to go anywhere, and Arsenal surprisingly have been linked to Gundogan. That can be actually a good signing, you know, if they get in both Gundogan and Declan Rice, then it's all a lot of the problems for them. But if Gundogan goes somewhere else and Bernardo Silva ends up leaving, City might just come in for the Declan Rice bid, and then I don't think Arsenal will be in a position to do anything about it. So a lot of what Arsenal do, interestingly, depends a lot on what happens in Manchester.
Yeah, it's a bit of the domino effect, right? Let's say Gundogan maybe goes to Arsenal or Barcelona. Then Arsenal, if he goes to Barcelona, then maybe Arsenal will have to buy Declan Rice. And if Arsenal get Declan Rice, City will have to, you know, go for someone else. So it depends on who kind of blinks first. If, let's say, Arsenal get Declan Rice, maybe City push and renew Gundogan's contract, give him exactly what he wants. But maybe Gundogan is also looking for a change. So it'll be an interesting situation to see.
Yeah, or, you know, if Gundogan goes to Barcelona, then City become all the more intent about Declan Rice. And then Arsenal have a problem as to who do they sign, because both Declan Rice and Gundogan are suddenly no longer available to them.
Exactly. It's a question of who blinks first. Yeah.
This is going to be another extremely tricky situation.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on from these teams, you know, who are in a year of transition to a team trying to go to the next level, we come to a team where, frankly, I don't know what phase Liverpool are in. Are they the team who are now looking to come from sixth, you know, back into the top four? Or are they a team who just had one bad season, now will be back to where they have been for the past couple of seasons, that's challenging Manchester City for the title? The only signing they have so far made is McAllister. And I know McAllister won the World Cup. He's extremely hyped. Teams were looking at him, and Liverpool were very, very quick to close that signing for a paltry sum of £35 million. So it's definitely a move in the right direction. But McAllister alone is not going to fit the problems of that midfield, right?
Right. I mean, they've just looked at a Gini Wijnaldum replacement in terms of the numbers that McAllister puts in. That's what I've read. It's very similar in terms of stats that Gini Wijnaldum had during his peak season at Liverpool and what McAllister kind of bringing in at Brighton. So it's a very mathematical signing, I would say, but he wouldn't fix all the problems for sure. You still need a proper, I think a younger Henderson, in my description, would probably be a good fit for their midfield.
How does that midfield look to you now? Does Fabinho become that pivot or the person sitting in front of the defense, and then a McAllister and let's say Trent coming into midfield, or he starts the season with Henderson or maybe hopes Alcantara through some magic potion is fit for the entire season? Or does he also go in and sign in a holding midfielder? Because Fabinho also is not fit for majority of the season. And then we have seen that Harvey Elliott is not the answer.
Exactly. I mean, Harvey Elliott, and I think they had Carvalho, who kind of fit into midfield at a couple of times a season. They are not what Liverpool's midfield is, at least a Jurgen Klopp midfield is. They need proper, you know, engines in midfield who they don't have. Fabinho is unreliable only because he's injured. He's a brilliant player. They'll have to bring in someone else. But do Liverpool really have the funds to, you know, fit in another midfielder after getting McAllister? I'm not too sure.
That's where I was surprised, you know, that they let Yuri Tielemans go to Aston Villa. And we know that all Liverpool three. Were tracking Tielemans for a very, very long time and not signing him for a free. Especially when this was the year when Tielemans would have tried to prove himself, right? Given the season he had at Leicester. So that really, really shocks me. And also, I don't know why they are not linked with a player like James Maddison. I mean, people can have their disagreements, but Maddison again would have been a very cost-effective option for Liverpool.
Right, but this is Liverpool, man. I mean, somehow they get the transfer season right every single season. Even last season, if you think of it, apart from the jokes we made about
Darwin,
the striker up front, Darwin, he still kind of had a decent season in terms of the output that he had. So you never know; they'll somehow make something of it.
It'll be very interesting to see what turns out of the Liverpool's transfer window. And right off the bat, no matter what they do in the transfer window, it just, again, seems like a season where Klopp will have to extract every possible drop of juice from his entire team to, again, go back to challenging Manchester City. But again, he keeps doing that, so you can never, ever count Liverpool out. To enter Miami, a transfer which supposedly involves a revenue-sharing agreement with the MLS. On top of that, Apple will be paying Messi a cut of the subscription revenue that they make out of the MLS. On top of that, he has complete image rights, and there's obviously the now a small inconsequential salary which Inter Miami will be paying him. Himanshu, are you surprised the Saudi Arabia move didn't happen?
Not surprised the Saudi Arabia move didn't happen. I think Messi has just become tired of football. You know, he's just looking for retirement. I'm really glad, if you remember the World Cup final before this one, where Mario Götze scored that winner and, you know, Argentina had to kind of wait for another 4 years to kind of have a go at the World Cup again. Because let's say Mario Götze had scored, right? Maybe Messi would have gone close to retirement back then itself. Honestly, I'm glad we saw so many years of Messi again. But I think Messi has kind of put his boots up. He's won everything, nothing else to prove. He doesn't like the pressure, doesn't like the negative press around him, you know, trying to make it at Barca while Barca are getting rid of players. He doesn't want any of the negativity anymore. Just wants to go to the MLS, chill, have a good life in Miami. And that's what's happened. So he's not chosen money. He's not chosen football.
He's chosen money, but he has not chosen, let's say, the biggest offer on the table for sure. Because Saudi was definitely paying him three, 4 times what he would have earned. He's going to earn it into Miami.
Exactly. So he's just chosen the middle and way out of football, maybe. But I'm glad we got so many years of Messi. I think it's time we move on to the Haaland-Mbappe rivalry, right?
Even for the MLS, though, I know other players have signed for MLS over the past couple of years. Zlatan Ibrahimovic went there. Famously, David Beckham but popularized this trend of players going there. Others have gone, Lampard, Gerrard, Rooney. But this is the marquee signing, right, for MLS. Because even though Messi will be more relaxed than he has ever been, he's still not a player who's completely faded away. There's still 1 or 2 years of football, high quality football still there in him. He's going to draw more eyeballs for them than ever come into the sport.
Yeah, I think he's going to absolutely boss it at Inter Miami. That's one of the worst teams in the MLS. So he'll have his work
That's
cut out for him.
That's largely because of another class of 92 product, Phil Neville, who was sacked by David Beckham.
Yeah, couldn't make it to our top, the combined squad anyway. So that's okay. It's for sure he has work cut out for him, but I'm sure he is going to boss it. In terms of your question about whether, you know, he's of course a marquee signing. MLS had lost a little bit of their stature maybe because of Chinese Super League, because of the Saudi Arabian League now coming up. This is one way to kind of get the, you know, spotlight on them again.
Definitely. And the big thing with MLS in the US is it's peculiar, right? Because MLS matches are generally sold out. There's a small fan base. So the viewing fan base is roughly 2 to 4 million people. But the stadiums are extremely packed. It's a very unique position, you know, in terms of US sports. So, and I think this is where Messi will be extremely crucial, because fans are already there in MLS stadiums. They will already make the noise when he's there. But what he's going to enhance is that TV audience, and he's going to, and that stadium right. atmosphere, which is a huge part as to why fans come in and start watching a sport. And if he starts his career in MLS with a bang, then nothing like it. Then absolutely nothing like it. So, yeah. Mm. And at this age, whether he learns anything new footballing-wise or not, I really think Messi will have to finally learn English. So, I'll be able to at least understand what he says in interviews.
Yeah. Mera bubu will finally change.
Yeah. So, there it was. Our 15th episode in the bag. Capping off the treble. And all the latest rumblings in the transfer market. I hope you've had a fantastic time listening to us so far. Please like, share, subscribe. And please continue to rate our show also, because that's another way as to how new listeners can discover it on their respective podcast platforms. Also, keep spreading the word about Pints of Football. You spreading good word about us is the only way that we can grow. Until then, see you.